From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Masters begins tomorrow at the legendary Augusta National Golf Club in Georgia. It is among professional golf's most prestigious tournaments, bringing some of its biggest names, like Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger Woods. Last week, the famous green made history, hosting its first women's tournament, the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Bob Herrig is senior golf writer for ESPN. He's in Augusta now. And Bob, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Anya Alvarez, she's former Ladies Professional Golf Association player and now a woman sports journalist on the line from New York. Anya, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Bob, I'm going to start with you. And a look at the golf course itself, what makes it such an important and famous one?
Oh, well, there's a lot of factors there, I think. It was founded by the great amateur player Bobby Jones in the early 1930s. He was a revered figure in the game back then. His friends in the game, the media at the time, they sort of revered him, looked up to him. And when he started his own tournament, which he did not want to call the Masters, it was called the Augusta National Invitational Tournament in 1934, it almost immediately had significance just because his name was attached to it. And through the years, of course, it grew, and it being played at the same place, a very it's got a beauty about it. It's got the green. People see it on TV and want to be here. And so it's sort of grown in stature, obviously, over the years into now what's, probably the most watched golf tournament of any.
And it's got strong traditions at the club, prestige, exclusivity, only about 300 members of Augusta National Golf Club. You have to be invited to become a member. Also, decorum, stringent rules, no running, no cell phones or cameras, no autographs, no backward hats, no fishing. Are these, Bob, part of the appeal?
I think for some. I mean, I think some of those things might be an annoyance for others, but, it's their club, their rules. I know from a media standpoint, the no cell phone policy, which even we cannot take out of the media center, that's hard to get used to in this day and age. It's fans at other golf tournaments, it's routine to see them with phones, taking photos, keeping up with. Golf is a hard sport to follow. You don't see all the action in front of you, so you can keep up with things on your phone. You can't do that here. And in some ways, it's nice. It's a throwback. I don't know that everybody likes that. I'm not sure every Augusta National member likes some of the rules, but I think they're willing to put up with them to be a member at a place that, that's not easy to get into, as you noted.
Well, throwback is part of the key here. Did not admit its first black member until 1990. And for many years, no women were admitted as members. How did this endure, even among generations of women fighting for equal rights and Title IX?
Well, unfortunately, I think you have to look at golf in general. And it's a sport that has always been slow to embrace social change. I mean, not just at Augusta National, but the sport in general. It's been a somewhat of an elitist game. It's played by older, more affluent people, typically white. The PGA itself didn't allow its first African American members until 1961. Baseball, other sports had been integrated long before that. The Masters didn't invite its first black player to the tournament until 1975, Lee Elder. So then when it comes to the women's issue, it was just 14, 15 years ago that, there were protests about the women's policy. Now, I always make sure I say that it wasn't that women weren't allowed, it's just that they had no women members. I think there is a distinction. But the reason it became such a talking point is this is such a public place 1 week a year. And Augusta National has a seat at the table in terms of governing the game. They're a very important entity. They run one of the four biggest tournaments. And for them to not have women members just increasingly became more and more of a problem.
Well, Anya, for you as a professional woman's golfer, were you among those protesters who thought this is not right?
To be honest with you, I have a stance that a private club should be able to do what it wants, but at the same time, it's going to be held to a higher level of scrutiny if they are hosting a tournament like the Masters. and profiting as much as they do off the tournament. So those types of clubs that are, you know, willing to let women come and be part of the audience or the spectators and profit off of them should maybe consider having them also be members of their club. That, but yeah, I mean, I think private clubs should be able to do what they want.
But the no woman rule really came into the forefront in 2012 when Virginia, Ginny Romedy, became the first woman CEO of IBM. So Bob, that was a dilemma for Augusta. What's the story there?
Right. Well, actually, I think it was before that even. You know, the IBM had they sort of had a succession of CEOs who were offered membership at Augusta National. That's one of the tournaments and the club's biggest sponsors, and it went sort of hand in hand. And when she became CEO, that didn't happen right away. She was not invited. In fact, she wasn't even one of the first two that Augusta National invited in 2012. And you know, I think part of it is due to the pressure. They have maintained a stance that they will not be pressured. So they invited their first two women members in 2012 after a long time of pressure, but it sort of came at a point when maybe nobody was really expecting it. It was in the springtime. The Masters had been over with for at least a month. It was off people's radar a little bit, and they invited their first two, including Condoleezza Rice. And then Virginia came in a little bit later. It was maybe a year later. And now they have six women members. So it's taken a while. You know, they've moved slowly on that, but they have moved.
Well, in a way, it took IBM hiring its first woman CEO to make Augusta National invite its first member, right?
I don't think it was the only reason, but I think it probably opened up their eyes to the fact that, you know, look, this is, you know, we're being, you know, we're not being proper here. You know, we're not being right. And also, let's be honest, they must have had internal pressure from whether it was members who have wives and daughters who thought it was wrong, or from their sponsors who said, look, it's not good for us to be associated with you if you have this stance. Mm. You know, and so I think there might have been some pressure from a business standpoint that, you know, these people, these companies are paying millions of dollars to sponsor the Masters, to buy tickets, whatever their deals are. And, you know, we're supporting a club that doesn't invite women members. And as Anya said, it's not so much about a club that doesn't have women. It's about a club that is so public and makes millions and millions of dollars off the public one week a year, not doing that, and it's sending a bad message to the rest of the world.
The voice you just heard, that's Bob Herrick. He's with us from Augusta. He is senior golf writer for ESPN. Also with us, Anya Alvarez. She's a woman sports journalist and a former LPGA golfer. Well, let's move to 2018, when it was announced that Augusta National would hold its first women's tournament the following year, which was this year. Anya, had there been any specific criticism leading up to this move? Or like Bob said, do you think it was proactive on the club's part?
It's hard for me to say that it's proactive or even progressive to have a women's tournament at Augusta, because I think it's something that should have happened a long time ago. And then on top of that, I think the timing was really bad for the tournament, because they did it during the first week of the LPGA's first major of the year. So in my opinion, it ended up taking away a lot of attention from the women's major, which they considered their women's masters, the ANA inspiration. And it just felt like there was just so much hoopla built around this amateur event, like they were patting themselves on the back for being progressive and inviting these girls to play Augusta National. And the way that it was framed, too, was that the entire tournament was going to be played at Augusta, when it was really only the final round and the 30 players who qualified for the final round would get to actually play at Augusta. So I just, to me, I didn't have the same excitement that I guess a lot of people had, because it was just like, okay, it's 2018. This should not be a big deal.
All right. And it was the tournament was going to be a big deal. Is there any reason why they didn't choose to host a professional tournament rather than an amateur tournament?
I'm not sure what decision in terms of why they decided not to host a professional women's event. I think that they obviously wanted to piggyback off the Masters going into the week and build up momentum for the tournament, and they could not host a professional women's event during that week with the ANA inspiration, LPGA ANA inspiration. I don't know. I think they just thought that maybe this is a prime opportunity to do something, and an amateur event would be a good way for them to showcase support for women's golf.
Well, Bob, you were there. I heard Christine Brennan say this morning on Morning Edition that she saw many members of the club. They really did turn out for it. What did you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think the event itself, it actually came off a lot better than many expected. The golf was very good. There was a lot of spectators on site. They had a lottery for tickets. The women who were involved, and they actually all did at least get to play a practice round at Augusta on Friday. There, you know, there obviously are some concerns about only having the one round and it going up against the ANA. These are legitimate issues, but when you just dig down into the event itself, I thought it came off really nicely. The play was excellent. The fans, the people embraced it. The players, Tiger has talked about it. Some of the other players have talked about how well they thought it came off. It can certainly improve. But I would say that, you know, it's better than them not doing something. It's a step in the right direction.
Well, it's interesting to consider. I mean, a big move by Augusta National, paying off both financially, and they're getting a lot of positive press. But if golf as a sport had embraced women, I mean, look, we've seen the growth of women's sports exponentially in the past 20 or 30 years. Did golf miss a chance to capture a woman's market, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the big things going forward is it's a growth area for the game. The two biggest areas where the game can grow are juniors, young people, and women. I mean, it's almost untapped. I mean, it's just such a small percentage of those entities that are playing. And if you want to get them interested, you need to give them reasons to be. Now, you know, I think the good thing that came out of the women's amateur is you'll have young girls now aspire to play in it. That's a goal for them to try to get here. And I can assure you, the ones that were here were thrilled and, you know, ecstatic about the opportunity. Well, now, you know, you might have a 10 or 12-year-old girl who thinks, if I can get my game in shape and be a really good junior player, amateur player, I'll have a chance to go there. You know, that's a good thing. It's the same thing with the junior thing they're doing, the drive, chip, and putt they do on Sunday. Is it enough? Probably not. I mean, there could be way more. Certainly, the idea of hosting a professional women's event here, it would have to be away from the Masters. If they could somehow pull that off, the interest in that would be off the charts. It would be tremendous. But, you know, it's easy for me to say they should do that. There's so many other things that go into that. But I think this is a good first step.
Well, Anya, 30 seconds left. What do you think? If this had happened 20 years ago, what would golf look like today for women?
I think that we would be having a much different conversation around the women's game. And then, to Bob's point, there was great golf that was played at the Augusta Women's Amateur. We saw that women can play at Augusta. And I think now that that stage has been set, hopefully then in the future we can give LPGA players the opportunity to show what they can do at Augusta as well.
Anya Alvarez, thank you so much. And Bob Herrig, thank you. Anya's a woman sports journalist, former LPGA golfer. And Bob is going to be there carrying it at Augusta, senior golf writer for ESPN. Stay with us for a couple who's doing the whole Appalachian Trail. We're going to find out why and keep in touch with them while they hike it. This is On Second Thought. From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hundreds of people each year set out to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. That means the whole thing in one go. And we're going to follow two of them.
Hello, I am Tina Haver-Curran.
And I am Grayson Haver-Curran. We are married.
Yay!
Tina and Grayson are what you'd call ramblers. In 2017, they sold their home and crossed the U.S. and parts of Canada in a 24-foot RV with lots and lots of CDs shoved into a binder and the tools of their trade, laptops.
I've lived in, for the most part, urban areas, and I think there's something really unique and special about going out and exploring your home place on foot, inch by inch, sleeping in the outdoors a bit, meeting the other people who have traveled great distances to explore it, there's a way to understand your homeland that I think when you're just zooming by in a car or hopping from city to city to city, that you don't fully understand.
The husband and wife team are both writers. Grayson regularly reviews records for Pitchfork and does features for NPR Music. Tina's got a solid resume as creative strategist and producer for clients from art museums to IBM and Toyota. They ditched the RV and are now hitting the Appalachian Trail on foot, with no laptops, no music, and spotty cell service.
I'm a little nervous about my bones and joints. I believe they're about 400,000 miles of uphill. So, you know, we will hike the length of the trail. It's much easier to hike the width of the trail, by the way, if you're interested.
You can do that in about 5 minutes, if that.
The length of the trail with, you know, between 20 and 35 pounds on our back, which is, you know, more than the size of a baby. Several babies on their back, which is a lot.
Tina and Grayson will be sending us updates of their trip via voice memo from time to time on their 2,000-plus-mile trek from Amicola Falls State Park in Dawsonville, Georgia, up to Mount Katahdin in Maine.
So we're going to do about 9 miles today from Amicola Falls to get to the base of Springer Mountain, the official start of the Appalachian Trail.
The summit of Springer. We're hiking to the summit of Springer Mountain.
Oh, yes.
Which is the start
the
of the
summit.
Appalachian Trail. And then we will have a happy walk downhill for about 7 miles and set up camp for the night, if all goes well, for about 15 miles, 15 and a half miles on our first day.
We're listening to their very first message before many days of physical exertion and intellectual wandering, things a lot of us dream of doing.
Well, we're going to leave in about 30 minutes. If someone were to ask me why I was doing this, at this present moment, I don't really know how articulate my answer would be because I'm kind of a ball of nerves.
Are you asking yourself why am I doing this at the very moment? We're in that stage of the journey.
So you know, we're doing it because why not, in a way?
Edmund Hillary climbing Everest, they asked him, why do you want to go to the top of the highest mountain on Earth? It's so inhospitable. And he said, because it's there.
I believe it was.
We better fact check that one, though.
She's right. It was actually George Lee Mallory talking of Everest 3 decades before Edmund Hillary's 1953 climb with Tenzing Norgay. Mallory and his partner, Andrew Irvine, did not make it to the top of the world's highest peak, nor did they ever make it down again. We're going to continue to hear about the far less perilous journey of Tina and Grayson Haver-Curran. You can follow them at Currency, that's C-U-R-R-I-N-C-Y, on Instagram, and we'll be speaking with them on Second Thought. Music in this segment from Jason Leonard and Kamiko. When it comes to hip-hop, Atlanta boasts some really big names. There's CeeLo, T.I., Ludacris, Andre 3000, Big Boy, Killer Mike, and the list goes on, with new chart toppers coming out of the Southern Capital all the time, which was not always the case. Jewel Wicker is an Atlanta-based entertainment reporter. Her recent article for Vice chronicles how Atlanta's hip-hop notoriety got a big boost from its club scene and club hits like the one you're hearing now, What's Up, What's Up by Playa Poncho. And Jewel Wicker is here to tell us more. Jewel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So the 90s, kind of big battle between East Coast and West Coast hip-hop, you know, Biggie, Tupac. There was Atlanta there in the middle at this time. What was going on there in terms of a hip-hop city?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think we tend to have some revisionist history when we look back on the 90s when it comes to Atlanta music, because we did. We had So Def and we had LaFace, which was producing Outkast and all of these things.
Huge record labels.
Yeah, but Atlanta really had to fight to prove that it was a hip-hop city, I think, originally. And, you know, in the 90s, for much of the 90s, it was still a lot of East Coast and West Coast and music from other cities, Miami, Memphis, other southern cities that were really penetrating the club scene, Freaknik, all of the nightlife here in Atlanta.
So this was by 1995 at the Source Awards in New York City. Andre 3000 of Outkast accepted the award for Best New Rap, and he was booed. Why?
Well, that was the height of the East Coast, West Coast, you know, saga. And I think that, you know, it's funny because I talked to DJ Nabs about this moment. And he's like, we tend to look back at it and think that's when the tides turned. The minute Andre 3000 said the South got something to say, everybody listened up and Atlanta became the hip hop mecca. But no, it still was a fight at that point. And we still had to prove that we had something to say and that Atlanta was a city that should be listened to.
Yeah, so you started looking into this history and found rapper Lil Jon among those that you follow in a venue called Club 559. This is near Atlanta's West End. Lil Jon said he had to make the crowd there dance if a song was going to be a hit in the city. Here's a little bit of his song, Who You With? So he's telling the audience to dance. So Lil Jon actually made songs that were designed not for radio or for the charts, but for these clubs. Why is that significant?
Well, you know, Lil Jon is from here. He went to high school here. He grew up hosting parties here and then went on to start DJing reggae sets at clubs for AUC students. Then he entered 559. He really was a patron of that club. And he talks about, you know, making Who You With and sending it to DJ Greg Street. And he was like, what is this? But, you know, Lil Jon was in these clubs. He knew what they were about. And so he was really able to make that first song for the clubs because he was a part of the scene. I think that's really interesting. And I think that's why Jermaine Dupri eventually made him A&R of So So Def, because he knew that Lil Jon knew what was going on in those clubs.
Jermaine Dupri running a big record, a record company that was a lot of national interest in at that time. But let's look at Club 559. It was pretty much frequented by Atlanta locals. Is that who was there?
Yeah, I think it's funny because if you go back and you look at media coverage at that time, it wasn't very favorable. I think it was like the rowdy club. It was locals. It was a lot of traffic coming to that residential neighborhood. But the locals really looked at it as a hub. That was where they went after work to party and to let loose and to have fun. And I think maybe if you weren't from Atlanta, you didn't understand that culture. So it wasn't perceived that well. But the locals, for the locals, it was everything.
Well, how about the other club that you look at, Club Kaya, attracted both locals and transplants? This is a place where newcomers not always welcome. How did Atlanta's hip-hop club scene react to outsiders?
Well, you know, I think Club Kaya, when we look at Club Kaya, DJ Nabs had a set there, but then eventually Frank Ski had a set there, and he's a transplant. He wasn't from here, but he talks about how the club scene in Atlanta is really what drew him to the city when he was interviewing to move here. And he looked around and he saw that there wasn't, you know, house music or things that transplants from up north were listening to. And so he was able to create a set that really spoke to those transplants. So it was really the best of both worlds.
So he was a DJ from Baltimore, came down here, DJed in the club. And now, of course, he's Frank Ski on B103. Right. But DJ Nabs, one of these transplants that you talked to, he recorded all of his sets. So does he have all this on cassette?
Oh, my God. I went to DJ Nabs's like archival room, and it is like a candy store. And he has like a 5-5 because he started at 559 and ended up getting kicked out in a very interesting story. But he ended up going to Club Kaya after that. He has like a 559 blazer, and he recorded all of his sets. And he said, I asked him why he did, and he said, my mom told me to write everything down, so I did. And now he has these archives that he's able to license out when MTV does like Behind the Music. And, you know, when all of these things look at the history of Atlanta music, they go to him because he has all of this on cassette.
Wow. So what are some of the names that came through on these nights at DJ Nab sets at Club Kaya?
crisscross, of course. I mean, because DJ Nabs was their DJ. He actually toured with them and Michael Jackson at one point. But then Jay-Z, you know, before Jay-Z was as big as he is today, but Jay-Z came through and did a set and he performed Money Ain't a Thing with Jermaine Dupri. I mean, that's a moment to remember.
Yeah, and he's got that on cassette?
He has that. He has it all.
Well, so long before the New York Times called Atlanta's hip-hop center of gravity were Atlanta's clubs. And entertainment reporter Jewel Wicker wrote about them. She dug into this club scene that catapulted the city's hip-hop scene, really. So many of the artists performing at the clubs we've been talking about were not from Atlanta, but coming to Atlanta to hang out in these clubs. How was their influence felt on the music being born here?
Well, it's interesting because when you look at, you know, I think in the early 2000s, Whitney and Bobby lived here. Diddy has long called Atlanta his second home. So, you know, his group 112, he met them outside of Club 112. That's where they got their name from. He was very much a part of clubs like Kaya. And if you talk to DJ Nabs and other DJs that were there at that time, they'll talk to you about hearing them party and all of those things. So, I mean, I think they were very influential and a big part of Atlanta becoming what it ended up becoming.
And did they bring the business interest here too, or were they just coming here for inspiration and that kind of alchemy?
Well, I think they kind of realized that Atlanta had the, you know, now people know that Atlanta talent is kind of where it's at when it comes to Atlanta hip hop. But I think they were some of the early people who realized that, you know, but back in that time we had LaFace. Like I said, we had So So Def in the early 2000s. We had Ludacris, who was a DJ here, ended up opening his own label, Disturbing the Peace. T.I. had Grand Hustle. So I think we had a lot of business there. But eventually after, you know, the digital world came to be, those businesses kind of dissipated.
You just beautifully set up a ground zero moment. 2001, the city gets its own anthem.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning. Welcome to
Atlanta, where the— All right, Jill, what are we listening to here? What happened in this moment?
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, Jermaine Dupri and So So Def was known to make music, like I said, for the clubs. That's why they enlisted Lil Jon to be A&R there in the early 90s. And so this was really an ode to Atlanta partying, right? It's still to this day when we had the Super Bowl in January. I couldn't tell you how many times I heard this song. It is still the Atlanta anthem.
Well, every city needs its anthem. But it is one thing to have fun at a party, another to turn that into what is now a musical legacy. How did this club scene launch Atlanta into the hip-hop capital that we now know?
Well, I think for many reasons, Atlanta became the hip-hop capital. You know, it was a great place to party, but when you look at the reasons that we had such a vibrant nightlife, the reasons that we had Freaknik and all of these things in the 90s, it's because Atlanta was a black hub, right? We had the AUC Center, and we had all of these people who were coming here, like Diddy, to party. And I think that mixed with the fact that, you know, L.A. Reid and LaFace had come here, So So Def was here, it created a perfect storm for Atlanta to become what it is today.
So there's a lot of talent here today, but how about the record labels and the companies? Where are the big decisions being made about who gets recorded?
Well, I think that's a big conversation that we're having today. You know, like I said, when the digital boom came, a lot of those companies left or folded. And now we're starting to see some of those companies come back. Some record labels are coming back. We have streaming services like Pandora and Spotify have offices here, even though they're small. Cobalt, which is a publishing company, has an office here. We're starting to see some of that music business come back. And it really is because a lot of the talent is frustrated and kind of fed up with having to go to LA and New York when we're the ones that are making the music that really drives the culture.
So the clubs we've been talking about, many of them now closed. New ones have, of course, sprung up in their place. But what is Atlanta's club scene like now?
I mean, I think, you know, Diddy kind of talked about being frustrated when he came here for the Super Bowl and partied with Lil Jon and Jermaine Dupri, and was frustrated because clubs in general aren't what they used to be. You know, we have bottle service, we have VIP sections. Back then, there was no VIP section. There was no bottle service. Diddy and, you know, celebrities were just partying in the middle of the dance floor. And that's just not the way it is now. We have cell phones. Everybody is kind of going to be seen. So I think clubs have become more of it's capitalism, right?
Yeah.
Clubs are a moneymaker. And so they've found out ways to make more money. But that maybe has taken a little of the fun out.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder if that's so special ingredients, that kind of freedom that allowed this kind of music to be born and experiment and thrive.
Well, I think music is made differently now. And so I don't think that, I think that the clubs certainly play a role in if something becomes a hit in a small way, but I don't think it has the big as big a role as it did, you know, back in the 90s and back in the early 2000s. I think that's just a sign of the time. Everything is digital nowadays. You know, you can become a hit star from a meme, from TikTok, like we've seen with Lil Nas.
Right, or, right.
You know, so, yeah.
You don't need to be in a club.
You don't need to be in a club anymore.
Atlanta is, of course, trying once again to grow its music industry. Recently, Georgia Representative Erica Thomas announced plans to co-chair this Georgia Entertainment Caucus that could meet tax incentives for the music industry here in Georgia, like the movie industry. How could that play into the narrative and potential growth of Atlanta as a hip hop capital?
Yeah, so the tax incentive went into effect January of 2018. They're still trying to work it out. You know, I think the thresholds are a little high now. So they're still trying to figure out what is the proper threshold to really bring business here into the city in the way that we've seen with the film and the tax business. So we'll see how that goes. I think it'll take a little while for them to find their footing, but hopefully it works out.
Jewel Wicker, thanks for bringing us this part of Atlanta hip hop history we just don't hear about.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
She's an entertainment journalist based in Atlanta and again wrote for Vice about how Atlanta's clubs in the 90s helped fuel Atlanta into becoming a hip hop capital. We're going to leave you with Atlanta's own Migos with Walk It, Talk It. And a little programming note here, on Monday, we talked with Arts ATL film critic Beth Ward, who told us that the USA Today rated the Atlanta Film Festival number 2. We heard from a listener who said, really? And we got it. We looked. We checked. We've got it posted online if you want to hear about it. And we're going to learn about a new play about columnist Irma Bombeck and why her humor still hits home when On Second Thought returns. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For more than 3 decades, Irma Bombeck harvested laughs from her life as a suburban mom. Her syndicated newspaper column reached some 30 million readers, and in my house was frequently clipped and taped to the refrigerator. She was also a best-selling author and a regular on Good Morning America.
I've never gotten too choked up over household hints. Once I sent a suggestion to Good Housekeeping, pointing out that dust balls stored under the bed make wonderful safe toys for the baby. And our great little stocking stuffers. They canceled my subscription.
Bombeck was less well known for campaigning across the country for the Equal Rights Amendment. Just one of the things uncovered in Irma Bombeck at Wit's End. The play is wrapping up a sold-out run at the Aurora Theater in Lawrenceville this week, but will return to the theater next summer. In the meantime, we are getting a sense of a remarkable woman from Allison and Margaret Engel. They're twins who co-wrote the play and are with us from County Monaghan, Ireland, where they're on a writer's retreat. Allison and Margaret, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Yes, good.
Let's get a little bit of background on Irma Bombeck, who lived in Dayton, Ohio. You two grew up in Cleveland. Were you familiar with her column growing up?
This is Allison, and yes, we were. One of our earliest memories of Irma was coming home and seeing our mother at the dining room table holding the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and it was just shaking. She was shaking with laughter. And we would say, Mom, what's so funny? What's so funny? And she could only eke out 2 words, Irma Bombeck. So from an early age, we knew that this was a funny woman. And then we started reading her.
Well, what about her writing, do you think, struck a chord for your mom and so many others?
This is Margaret. She was so honest that she never tried to sugarcoat the bad feelings that sometimes crept up between mothers and children and fathers. And so by humorizing all of these very basic emotions that were behind closed doors and families, she really opened up the world of being honest and what a tough time it is sometimes to be a family member.
This is something that Mo Rocca, he's a CBS Sunday Morning correspondent, he visited Irma Bombeck's writing conference in Dayton and asked Gail Collins of the New York Times about why she thought Irma Bombeck inspired such a devout following.
Well, you know, it was a weird time then. You had this huge desire, especially in the part of the women's magazines and TV and TV ads, to portray life as a housewife as this great triumph in which you're cooking a chicken and then everybody applauds when you bring it to the table. The real wives know that none of this is happening, that this is a whole delusional thing. And millions of housewives instantly said, oh my gosh, yes, this is really the way we live. Oh, of course, yes, nobody ever died from sleeping in an unmade bed.
Nobody ever died from sleeping in an unmade bed. One of the famous Irma Bombeckisms. Any others come to mind that you came across in your research?
Well, she had so many. There are mugs that say, when humor goes, there goes civilization. And this is Margaret. Of course, the grass is always greener over the septic tank, but her really all-encompassing one, if life is a bowl of cherries, what am I doing in the pit?
So she was pretty frank about her life. There was doldrums, but she mined a lot of joy out of it. So I want to fast forward from when you first saw your mom laughing over Irma Bombeck. Several decades later, you two write this play about Irma Bombeck. What inspired you to revisit her work as the subject of your own work?
This is Margaret. We had written a play about Molly Ivins, another very funny and political woman journalist. And one of Irma's sons saw the play and thought, this should happen for my mother's work experience, too. So Irma's longtime agent, Aaron Priest, asked us if we would tackle Irma. And he had no idea that we were also Buckeye Ohioans and that we had grown up loving Irma. So it was a really terrific match.
What do you think her son wanted to communicate about his mom?
This is Allison. This was Matt Bombeck, the youngest, and he lives in Los Angeles, which is where he saw the play. And he's a writer himself, so I asked him one time, why didn't he write the play? And he said that he was too close to it. But I think that one of the things that they felt strongly about, and they didn't interfere in any way, they were only helpful when we were asking research questions, was how normal their upbringing was. I mean, Irma Bombeck was one of the most famous women in America, and she was in 900 newspapers and was so well known, but her children did not really have that sense of her at all. When they got home from school at 2:30 or 3, the office was closed up and she was just mom. And in fact, when Matt was in kindergarten, he was asked what his mother did, and he said very sincerely, she's a syndicated communist.
I've seen interviews with them where they say that she actually, even though she was traveling all the time, she's making $500,000, $1 million a year, a lot of money at that time. She was still cleaning her house, grocery shopping, and freezing casseroles for them with instructions for when she left. So she stayed true to who she was.
Yes, and this is Allison. It really is, that is one of the most remarkable things about her, because especially now in this age of celebrity, she was, as you said, on Good Morning America. She was one of Johnny Carson's favorite guests, but she did not go Hollywood, and she stayed in Dayton, Ohio for years and years, and then was in Scottsdale, Arizona, and she just did the normal thing. And her husband, Bill, was notorious for turning off the light all the time. And he was a high school teacher and then a principal. So they lived a very normal life, which is truly remarkable given her celebrity and the wonderful things she accomplished.
I actually dove into Irma Bombeck clips on Johnny Carson after reading about your play. One of the things that she says, like on her deathbed, she imagines looking up at her kids and saying, I told you I was sick. We are speaking with Allison and Margaret Engel. They're twin sisters, co-writers of the play Irma Bombeck at Wit's End. The play is closing at the Aurora Theater in Lawrenceville this Sunday, but is going to return next summer. So you were an adult woman by the time you took on this project in a completely different era when women working outside of the home, that was the norm. Irma Bombeck used to joke about her only social life being visits from the Avon lady. So does this writing about her life and that time, does it still work?
This is Margaret. I believe it does. And we have been so surprised to see how many men come to the theater and get choked up and sentimental about what is before them on the stage, because it reminds them of their own mother and how selfless most of them were. And also young people have really gotten the humor because they all grew up in households. As Irma said, you know, we're part of a very mixed up, dysfunctional house, and we're happy to acknowledge it.
Hmm.
So I do think that it, because she roots everything in human behavior, it does last.
So this is Allison. As we look through her speeches, her books, her columns, really there were very, very few things that did not translate to today. There was the maybe odd reference to Joey Hetherington or somebody that isn't so well known today. But because she really concentrated on universal truths within a family, it's as true today. In fact, we feel that most of her columns could just rerun now.
Well, she was campaigning across the country for passage of Equal Rights Amendment. She was on the President's Advisory Committee on Women in the 1970s. This is something I had no idea about. What did you discover in your research that was different from the columnists you remember from your childhood?
This is Margaret. We were stunned to know that she took 2 years to travel the country on her own dime because she felt so strongly about equality for women. She was a child of the Depression, and her dad died when she was 9 years old, something that also happened to Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem. They lost their mothers, were widows at very young ages, and they saw the economic pain that they went through. So she was incredibly committed. In fact, Irma said that she wanted to have on her tombstone, "I got Missouri for the ERA." And the sad thing is that she didn't, and that the ERA went down to defeat, and it was one of the huge losses of her life.
So this is something that she, you know, today countless women, men, and brands label themselves as feminists, but it's still a pretty polarizing term. Do you think that Irma's messaging, which was a little more stealthy, might have reached more as a result?
This is Allison. Yes, we totally believe that if Irma had been asked to join the Equal Rights Amendment fight earlier, it might have passed. She volunteered herself. No one came to her and said, "We'd like you to travel around the country." And she really represented middle America. And so I think her message reached people in a way that perhaps Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem didn't, because they were more polarizing figures. But she, you know, I think that she really touched, you know, kind of the average American, and she spoke at beauty parlors and bookstores and senior centers, all in states that had not yet passed the amendment.
Hmm. Well, and maybe forecasting a criticism that later came out about those early, the early second wave feminists, or women's libbers as they were called, she chided feminists for giving a war and not inviting the housewives, you know, that they were left behind. What do you know about what the women's libbers, I'll say, thought of her?
This is Margaret. They adored her. And if the circle had been wider at the beginning, I think the result might have been happier. And there are efforts now to revive the ERA. And I would think what a honor that would be in Irma's name if it would, after all these years, finally pass, because the circle has been broadened and it is so widely accepted across this country, the whole notion of women's equality and equal pay for equal work.
Irma Bombeck was not the only widely read woman writing a syndicated column at the time. There was Ann Landers and Dear Abby, famously. What set Irma Bombeck's work apart?
This is Allison. She never pretended to be an advice columnist, which the twin sisters, Abby and Ann, were. But there were other, they called them housewife columnists, and Jean Kerr was one, and there were a couple others. But I think what set Irma apart, first of all, she was such a disciplined and dedicated and good writer that her writing has endured. And some of the others were maybe just a little cutesy, and the humor hasn't really lasted over the years. And I think that
Irma really was considered herself a journalist, which is interesting. Her children told us that she never endorsed any product and was very, you know, stuck to journalistic principles because she felt that what she did, she took it as a real calling. So I think that set her apart from some of the other people writing.
Even up until the end, she refused to use her celebrity in any kind of advantageous way, so sticking to the principles of journalism. I read just a wonderful obituary, I think it was in the LA Times. She needed a kidney transplant. She had a rare kidney disease, and she was offered by readers, 30 of them offered to donate a kidney. None was a match, but she refused to use her celebrity to move higher on the list of people waiting for a kidney transplant. I just couldn't help but think, like, do they make them like Irma Bombeck anymore?
Yeah, this is Margaret. She truly is an American icon because she really represents the best of American stoicism and just getting the job done and doing it all with this very wicked sense of humor. She loved to do titles, and she would collect and work assiduously to make sure that all of her columns and all of her books had the right title, because she did have that sort of commercial aspect to her that she wanted to bring in her readers. This is Allison. I think the situation about her not jumping the line to get a kidney transplant is totally in keeping with her character. And she had lots of longtime good friends. As I mentioned earlier, how normal their lives were in the face of somebody who was so well known. And I think that this was just of a keeping. Her longtime agent told us that you could tell her there was all the money in the world, a doorway away, and all she'd have to do was walk through that door. She would not do it if she didn't feel that there was a good reason behind it. And that's why she never became commercialized or endorsed any product. I mean, you could imagine Irma Bombeck irons would have, flown off the shelf.
Well, Allison Engel and Margaret Engel, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing a little of a person that, may be unknown to a lot of listeners and may be known very warmly to others. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
That is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Amelia Brock, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Jesse Neiswanger is our engineer. Don Smith, our dean of grammar. Amy Kiley is senior producer. And Sarah Shariari is managing editor for GPB News. We invite your comments, questions, and civil complaints at our Facebook group, GPB Radio On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott on Facebook at Virginia Prescott GPB, which could frankly really use some love. We're here Monday through Friday at 9 or anytime when you subscribe to our podcast. Hit the programs tab for On Second Thought at gpbnews.org to subscribe.